Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Dan Lynch joins me. We're going to be talking about Oracle Open Source, specifically microcontainers. They're all the rage now. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch, episode 451, recorded September 20th, 2017, Oracle Open Source. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you might want to download right after this show and play with it. I bet today's going to be one of those. Joining me once again, welcome back, Dan Lynch, back as a co-host.
Hey, it's good to be here once again.
Yeah. Thank you for stepping forward on this one, because it's starting to, we have so many shows that are being booked solid. It's like, it's, you know, we have no chance to take a break anymore. So I'm glad you're back and at least still putting your toe in for the, you know, having a co-host position here. So I'm really good to be back. I mean, after all that time that you were gone. So where are you speaking to us from? I could kind of guess, I think, from looking at the surroundings.
you can probably guess. I'm in my, my office stroke studio at home. I'm in England, in the northwest of England, just near on the outskirts of Liverpool at the moment, cool. Which some of you will have heard of.
Yes, I think there was some band from there, maybe Led Zeppelin. No, who's from there?
The Rolling Stones, something like that.
Stones, yeah, it's one of those, right?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Some famous band from there. So today we have a show that. Oh, wait, I should say where I'm speaking to you from. People who have watched the video a lot know that this is my very featureless wall in my Beaverton home bedroom. So using my hotspot again, and which is an absolute necessary today because our Wi-Fi has been down for 5 days here. So thank God, I have this unlimited use high-speed hotspot, and I'm very happy to be using that today. And hopefully we'll have only a few dropouts, things that won't be too bad. So what we're going to talk about today is Oracle Open Source. Now, Oracle actually approached me about this show, I think about 2 months ago, and I think maybe I bumped into them at a conference or something. I've been to so many conferences in the last 2 months, and I've got a bunch more coming up still, so it's just going to be crazy. I mean, it's anyway, so I talked to some people, and I had this big Oracle sign, and I said, so you're doing open source? Well, yeah, we got some more stuff, and mostly around the area of microcontainers. And so we're going to be talking about three projects today that are in their microcontainer offering, which is Smith, which is a simple command line utility for building microcontainers from RPM packages or OCI images, and CrashCart, which is a simple command line utility. They're all simple command lines, right? Simple command line utility that lets you sideload an image with Linux binaries into an existing container. That sounds interesting for debugging and things like that. And Railcar, which is a Rust implementation of the Open Containers Initiative runtime spec. So first off, I don't know what's different about a microcontainer. I read a couple of things about it, but it seems like what they're aiming for is a lighter weight thing. I mean, we've heard containers. We've had containers hundreds of times on the show, it feels like, already. You know, Docker, everything related to Kubernetes, all that sort of stuff. But I think what makes what Oracle's doing here a bit more unique is that they're really focusing on extremely lightweight deployment, still using the OCI format, and actually their Smith format, but trying to really reduce the size. And when you start deploying thousands of, you know, Docker images in a cloud, you really don't want those to be huge. And also, I see some of the problems related to it are related also to the layering, that sometimes it's really convenient when you do development, because you only want to rebuild the parts that have changed. But when you're actually deploying, all those layers actually add complexity in terms of delivery. So we're going to be talking about all that. But who are we talking to? We're going to be talking to a couple guys from Oracle, Bob Quillen, and I'm going to mispronounce this, Ishaya Abrams, I think. So is that still true? Yeah, that's okay. That's two guys, right? We'll be bringing them on in a few minutes, and we'll get all those questions answered that we want to answer. But Dan, you want to feed anything in here before we bring them on?
No, I mean, I am interested in the microcontainer idea. I've been reading the microcontainer manifesto that they've published, which is interesting. So, I think the idea of shrinking these images, as soon as, you know, scaling's the point, isn't it? Scalability. So you don't want big images. You want small kind of VMs that you can run, containers, sorry, So it should be interesting to find out more.
Oh, and actually, I mispronounced Vish's name, Vish Ishaya Abrams. I was reading only his middle name. I apologize for that. But, man, as long as we were talking about it, let's go ahead and bring them up. So, Bob Quillen, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, and I appreciate the chance to talk to you all. We've been working on a bunch of open source container activities and doing a lot of shows, a lot of conferences, a lot of products coming out. So looking forward to talking to you about these utilities and excited to be here too. So,
all right. And let's also go ahead and welcome Vish Ishaya Abrams. Hopefully I didn't mispronounce that too badly.
You got it perfect. Hi, I'm Colin from San Francisco. We're Berkeley, actually. It's great to be here.
Yeah. And Bob, where are you speaking to us from?
I'm coming from Austin, Texas. And happy to be talking to you guys across the podcast. So.
Okay. Well, this question's for either of you. I don't really know the hierarchy between the two of you, so I want to just start and throw this question out. What's the 30,000-foot view? What problem are we solving when we're reaching for these three tools?
So just a very, very brief background. We realize that Dockers have been excellent for development, but when you start taking them into operations, when you start going to production with containers, there's some things you really have to be concerned with. And the tools are primarily targeted at making production and operations easier and in a way that was valuable for us when we were developing our cloud technologies here at Oracle.
Well, is this a sort of thing that wasn't being solved in any way that fit? I mean, Docker's been around for a long time, so it hasn't Docker slowly evolved to solve these problems?
So in many ways, Docker does solve some of the problems, especially more recently. So obviously, when we started this effort, it was 2 years ago, and there were much more problems then. But we still use Docker for the runtime in many cases. So this is more designed as tools and techniques for building containers as opposed to running containers. We even often build with Docker to start with, and then we use, for example, Smith to shrink the container down at the end.
Let's do an overview of what these three things actually are then. So I just read the one sentence that I stole from the website. So let's talk about each one of these things. So let's start with Smith. What's that about?
Yeah, so Smith is basically a tool to take software and package it up in a very micro way. So we mentioned the micro container manifesto earlier. And the idea there is not just size in order to make it easier to deploy, but also to deal with things like security vulnerabilities, when you have changes that need to be made to the container and need to get them out quickly, to minimize security risks. When you have a whole bunch of stuff sitting in the container that's built by some random developer, you don't really know if you need to update your container for security vulnerabilities and things like that. So Smith is basically a tool to take your existing software in an RPM or even an existing container and then minimize it so that it only contains exactly what is needed to run the container when you're operationalizing it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting problem to solve because, I see people all the time taking just like a standard, even an Alpine Linux image has a lot of tools in it that would be a big attack vector if someone could manage to escape the jail. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And the tools are super useful during development. I mean, I think one of the things Docker has done extremely well, especially with their Docker for Mac products, et cetera, is that they've made it super easy for developers to use stuff. And that's great when you're going through that first phase of development, when you're just trying to get stuff built as quickly as possible. But then when you need to take that and put it into production, you have a different set of concerns. And Docker developers aren't really used to thinking about that kind of thing. They're used to an operational team taking over that's, you know, hardened their Linux and that's making sure that all the security vulnerabilities have been updated, et cetera. And suddenly you've got this big container that the developers know how to build, but nobody really knows how to operationalize and keep safe.
Okay, let's go ahead and look at the second project here, Crash Cart. Let's get kind of an overview of that. What problem is that solving?
Yeah, so this is actually an interesting story because it's sort of a problem that we create by the first problem, meaning that normally you have all your utilities in your container, right? And that's very useful, as I said, for development, and it's also useful for debugging. If you then take all those utilities out because you're trying to minimize updates and attack vectors, et cetera, you need a way to go debug things that go wrong. And many types of debugging you can do from the host. So, for example, you can enter the network namespace and TCP dump inside the container, et cetera. But there's a certain class of problems that you can't really do from the host. And that's when you need access to the container's file system and a file system where your tools are running at the same time. So your tools may be on the host, but say, for example, you wanted to do a very common Linux utilities LSOF. So you want to list the open files inside the container. If you're doing that from the host, you don't see the files and the sizes as you need inside the container. But if you try and change the file system into the container, LSOF isn't there, and so you can't run it. So CrashCart is essentially, think of it like the CrashCart you take and plug into in a data center when something goes wrong. So it's a way to have a bunch of utilities, TCB dump, LSOF, maybe GDB, things like that, sitting in a separate file system that you then mount into the container and can use when things go wrong.
Well, I could effectively just rebuild my container with the debugging tools in it, right? Or is that losing access to the state of an already running container that may be going awry?
Sure. Yeah, that's the one case where this becomes a little bit tricky, is if there's something going wrong and you need to live get in. Yeah, you can always have a debug version of the container, rerun it, and hope that you can reproduce the problem. But sometimes things are running in production, something goes wrong, and you need to go figure out what happened. And that's when this becomes useful. The really great thing about it is you can use it even if you haven't pre-created the container to know about it. So you can just be using any regular Docker container and then go in and load up CrashCart and get tools in there.
Okay, and so let's look at the third project. Where's the name down here? Scroll. Railcar. So what does that do for me?
So Railcar is I would think of it a little bit more on the research project side. As we were developing a lot of our internal container tools, this thing called the OCI spec, the Open Container Initiative spec, kind of came to the forefront. So we had Docker, and then Rocket appeared, and there were different container runtimes, and people said, hey, we need to have a common standard, which we think is a really important thing to have in this community, because otherwise you have a single vendor just building stuff and nobody else can interoperate with it. So the Open Container Initiative was founded, and there are two specs that they've released. One is the image spec. So Smith builds image compliant, OCI image compliant containers. And then there's the OCI runtime spec. And the OCI runtime spec is designed to be the way to run an existing container, how it's isolated by the operating system, et cetera. There's only really one implementation that uses Linux containers out there, and that's RunC, which is the original version that was made by the Docker team. We felt like, hey, there really needs to be more than this. There's one by Intel called Clear Containers, but that uses virtualization instead of containerization. So we've really felt like, to be true to the spec, we need to have multiple implementations. And so we went ahead and built an alternative implementation in Rust. Rust is a fascinating language, and it has some serious advantages for this particular use case, which we can get into if you're interested. But primary reason for creating it was just to have a second implementation of a containerization runtime.
Okay, let's talk about the overall track for these projects. So this is open source. Has it always been intended to be open source from the beginning?
Yes.
Okay, and so what license is it under?
So they're dual licensed under Apache 2 because that's the one that everybody knows and is comfortable with, and it's a great license. And the UPL, which is a very, very permissive license as well. It's very similar to Apache, but not a lot of people know about it. So all Oracle software, the policy is to release it under that license first. And so we included that license. But then in order to have a license that people are more familiar with, we also did Apache 2, which I think is a great choice.
And I wanted to ask a little bit about I mentioned when we were doing the intro there about the micro container manifesto that you've got on your website. I might try and bring Bob in a little bit here if he's still with us. Just to keep it throwing it round. I was just interested in the idea of a micro container. I mean, I'm sure most people listening to this, if they listen to Floss Weekly, they're likely to know about containers and what containers are and how they work. So is it really as simple as just saying a micro container is just a small container? What exactly is a micro container?
Yeah, well, I can answer a little bit about kind of the motivation behind it, and Vish can fill in a little more on the technical details. But, you know, our acquisitions, we came into Oracle, we were focused on Docker and containerization. This is almost 2.5 years ago with an acquisition called Stack Engine. And our approach was really trying to figure out, how do you take Docker apps into production? And we've been dealing over the last 3 years, similar to Vish and the rest of the guys on these teams at Oracle, is, you know, the size of the containers, the complexity, there's a lot of image bloat that comes around. And these layers that are added to images as you go through development cycles, there's value to that. But as you start going out to staging a production, the size of the images becomes a huge issue. Downloading those, managing those, the security issues have become front and center. So image size, performance, security all become kind of those next stage concerns as you go from the early development phases of containerization into production. And I think that's kind of where we've seen the market shift, big focus around things like Kubernetes, around operationalization. How do I run this in production? What happens when something goes wrong? How do I monitor it? How do I deal with security? How do I reduce the attack surface area? All those things, microcontainers help to really address, because they go to part of the heart of the problem. You only take what you need with you. If there's an issue, you can bring CrashCart in and use it. So it's a great best practice, and it's kind of what you'd expect as you go through this maturation phase of developers throw everything in. It's really simple for developers, but as DevOps and SRE and other sort of operational guys come in, it's really important to be able to have something that is more oriented towards the full life cycle, which is not just I'm developing it on my laptop and I can do anything I want to do, but now I'm in production, I got to fix it, I got to monitor it, someone else may have to maintain it, et cetera. And that's where microcontainers can provide that next set of best practices. And I think the industry is rallying around a lot of these kind of threads as we're dealing with this next phase of taking containers out of the development phase into production, into operational aspects, and hence a lot of things that come out with Smith and CrashCart and the work that we're doing there. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'll get more into the specifics of it with Vish in a sec, but I was just curious about these projects are all on GitHub. Are these live repos on GitHub, or are they clones of something you're working on that you then release? How does all that work operationally?
Vish, you want to talk about GitHub itself and how?
I've ambushed you again. Sorry.
I'll let Vish talk about the GitHub part, but they're
out. Okay. They're all live. We don't. We don't have an internal fork that we're working on. The one sort of hiccup is in order to contribute, you need to sign the Oracle Contributor License Agreement, which is something you have to actually sign and then mail or email in, which is kind of a pain. But aside from that, we've already had some contributions, and it's all being done in the open.
Excellent. Well, you've just preempted what my next question was going to be there, which is, are people contributing? So it sounds like there's been a fairly good reception so far.
Yeah, I mean, it's external contributors have been fairly minor. I think we've only had a couple, two or three people that have actually gone through the process and contributed. I think it would be easier if we didn't have that OCA requirement in. But of course, the lawyers have to have their say too.
Yeah, I know what you mean. A cynic might say that signing the contributor agreement could mean that your contributions were, proprietarized later on. Has anybody raised concerns about that, or am I just being difficult there?
We haven't had concerns about that. It's you're contributing under the open source license anyway, right? So I know that Oracle in the past has not had the best track record with open source, but we're really doing our best to change that. I mean, the new people that have come in these groups that are focused on the modern and new technology, one of our major focuses is really making open source Oracle a better open source player. And they've made some great steps in that regard.
Excellent. All right. And so seeing as we got into the microcontainer kind of definition a little bit, can you tell us a bit about the technical side of that, Vish? Is there a lot of challenges to shrinking a container? I'm just thinking about things like portability and so on. So if I make a container and then shrink it, is there a danger that I'm going to have trouble running it on another server somewhere, which obviously would really defeat the purpose?
Yeah, there isn't a concern about that. Probably the major concern is in order to shrink the container, essentially you have your initial container or RPM files and you're copying files out. So figuring out which files to copy out can be the tricky bit. And one of the nice things that Smith does for you is it actually will find any linked libraries that you're using by examining the binaries that you're pulling out and copy those automatically. Now that works great for things built with C, et cetera. But when you're getting down to things built in Python or a scripting language, or you have configuration files you need to pull in, it's a little bit of that has to be done manually. And so the biggest concern is that you didn't pull something in that you needed, but it doesn't show up in your testing phase, and then it's something you actually needed in the production phase. So that's I think the biggest pain point in doing it this way. And so you kind of have to weigh the advantages of having all of the positive side versus a little bit of pain on the side of making mistakes there.
And you mentioned, obviously, we've been through the three tools, and Smith is the one that people are using for creating these. Can you take us through a little bit about how I would create a microcontainer with Smith?
Sure. So basically, one of the things that we tried to do is simplify the process a little bit. So there are other ways of creating very small containers. And keep in mind that a microcontainer, it's not its own spec. I mean, it's still an OCI compliant image. It's just a set of standards or practices for how to build it and what to put in it. And in my opinion, having standards are very important, especially at a large company when you have a lot of people building things. And sometimes getting developers to follow standards, the best way to do is give them a tool to do it for them. Because if they don't have to figure it out themselves, they'll use it. If they have to read a big document, a Word doc that says what the spec should be, then they may not follow. So basically the way it works is there's two modes. One is building from RPM packages. So Oracle Linux obviously is a derivative that uses RPM. And so internally, that was the first thing we supported. And the other format is to build from an existing Docker container or OCI container. And essentially what you do is you say, okay, here's the, in the RPM format, you say, here are the packages I want to install. And then here's the binaries I want to pull out of those packages. And then it'll pull out any of dependencies, libraries that need to be pulled out. And produce a very small image for you. Now, there's usually a bit of back and forth. So you build it once, and then you're like, okay, well, I forgot the configuration files, for example. And then you go and you pull in the configuration files as well. So sometimes, you know, some of the examples in the README are very simple, and they work the first time. I put out an article on my blog about doing it with a little bit more complex piece of software like Apache HTTPD, which has some tricky bits. And that gets into a lot of the nitty-gritty of, okay, well, this doesn't work. How do I fix this problem? Like, I need a user in there. I need to pull in dynamically linked libraries that are loaded with LDOpen, et cetera.
And what about migration, like live migration and so on? I mean, I imagine that adds a complexity, because if you're, if I'm running something in a microcontainer and then I want to live migrate it to, I don't know, the other side of the world or something, it needs to know it's going to have all the stuff, over there to run, I suppose.
Sure. So, I mean, that's true. I mean, live migration in containers is not necessarily a solved problem. Most people do it by doing stateless service in containers and then putting a load balancer in front and just stopping the old one and starting a new one. There is support for checkpoint restore and user space in Docker that can do some of the migration. There's been some cool demos of people doing that. I haven't actually seen anybody try and do that in for real workloads yet. But in the good news about this particular case is it's just using the standard Docker runtime. And so anything that it can do, this can do also. It doesn't impose any new restrictions. And in fact, in many cases, it might make it easier because the pull on the other side of the container is going to be much smaller. So it'll load much more quickly than if you have to pull down like a 3 gigabyte image, for example.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that must be a big advantage in bandwidth and so on. You kind of probably answered it there, but I was just wondering whether you need to, if I've got, a Docker installation on, be it Linux or Windows or Mac or whatever, do I need to do anything specific to make it work with the Smith images or anything else?
No, I mean, there is one wrinkle in that Docker right now doesn't allow you to save and load OCI compatible images. So the OCI 1.0 spec is out and many things support it. Docker itself does not support using the Docker load command to pull in an existing OCI image. But the good news is Smith can push and pull from Docker repositories. So you can actually just push your image into a Docker repository, which will automatically convert it into the Docker format, which essentially is actually the OCI image format with a couple small changes in the JSON. And then you can pull it down from a repository. So it would be nice, and there's some work being done in the community to support OCI load and save directly from Docker, which will make that a little bit simpler, but it is definitely usable today.
And are you looking to upstream any of this like Docker does?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. I mean, honestly, the Smith, the whole strategy of Smith could be something that could be done sort of inside of Docker. So people that are trying to solve the same problems in Docker have been using something called the multi-stage builds, which you may be familiar with, where essentially you have one container that uses your build container, and then you pull out specific things into your runtime container. And people are using this a lot, especially if they're building, for example, a simple Go binary that is static. So they'll build in the build container, and then they'll copy out just the binary into the runtime container. And the runtime container will be based on something small like Alpine. And that works fairly well. The thing that it doesn't do is automatically pull in the dependencies for you. I wrote this Smith in Go specifically because I was like, hey, this whole community is in Go. It would be very easy to pull things out and put it into another system. In fact, in the past, there's a squash option to Docker that got added recently. That started as an external Go project called Docker Squash. And then enough people were using it, and people said, "Hey, this is really useful," and they pulled something into Docker directly. So I would love to see that happen. I think that's more up to the Docker maintainers as to whether or not they feel like this is a valuable addition and way of doing things. But it could very easily interact that way.
Excellent. That sounds really good. I mean, I'm just wondering. You mentioned before about the obviously there's a standard for OCI images and so on, and you mentioned there isn't a standard for micro images right now. Now, obviously, I'm not asking you to predict the future because I know you know that's tough for any of us. But do you think it's possible that there will become a standard for micro containers?
I mean, I don't see any value in creating an alternative standard to the OCI image standard. I've actually worked with OCI in the past for certain features that I thought were useful to help move towards microcontainers, and managed to get a couple of those changes in. So I think if anything, at this point, I don't think there's really much missing from the OCI image standard that would be needed to enforce. So the standards, it's best if they're flexible. If you get them too restrictive, then different people won't use them. But implementations, you want to be more restrictive because if you have too much flexibility, then everybody's doing something different and you don't have consistency across your organization. So I actually kind of like the layout right now where we have a very flexible standard, but then we have policy around making it a little bit more restrictive when we're building microcontainers.
One of the things I stumbled across as I was doing the research this morning is this thing called Oracle Linux as a base image. Does Smith eliminate the need for that, or is it parallel to, or can you describe the relationship there?
Yeah, sure. So it depends on what you mean by base image. So the Docker standard, the way that people have used Docker in the past is they take a base image and they put a new layer with their stuff on top. And Oracle Linux is a very similar to CentOS or Fedora or Red Hat Linux in that it's a base image. And, you know, a lot of people today use Alpine or Snappy, Ubuntu or Debian images as their base. So you could very easily use that as a base. And in fact, when we're starting, we often use one of those as a base. Now, ultimately, Smith is building an image that doesn't have any layers. There's a single layer. So it won't actually be based on the image. It'll just be the stuff that's been pulled out of the image afterwards. If you're building with RPMs, you actually don't specify an existing container image to start with. It uses a tool called Mock, which is something that was developed for Fedora to help with their RPM build process. And essentially, it gives you an isolated environment very similar to a Docker container, but not a Docker container, that has all of your yum dependencies installed in it, et cetera. If you're familiar with Debootstrap from the Debian community, it's very similar to that. And so what it will do is it will take your yum repositories and use those to install your RPM with all of its dependencies. And then you'll have this isolated environment, and it'll copy things out of that isolated environment. So it's very similar to the way that the Docker or OCI image version works, where it takes a container image and pulls things out. The container image is a little bit more flexible, once again, because you're able to use any base that you want. So the RPM version is a little bit more restrictive, but it makes for a bit more consistency. So traditionally, we've used that internally for building our containers. But the OCI one, I think, is probably going to be more commonly used in the wild because it's got that flexibility.
And just to follow up on the previous question, if I'm on a Mac, well, that's not an if. I am on a Mac. So yes. Yeah. So I know I can use, you know, the latest Docker releases. It uses Beehive and stuff like that. It's really, really slick. Just really a lot better than the old boot to Docker situation from a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing that I can't use CrashCart because that's looking like it's once local Linux binaries to sideload. Is that true?
Correct. So CrashCart, now it would be possible to make a CrashCart container perhaps that could do it. You can use Smith right now because you can, I have a Docker image where you can run Smith inside the Docker image to do the build. And that works on Docker for Mac. That's how I use it. CrashCart, probably not. You would have to actually go into the Docker, VM that's sitting in there and put it in there. So it's a little bit tricky to do in that particular case. But keep in mind, this is for production cases, right? Generally, what you would want is you would want your development image that you're doing that has all of your tools in it that's you're building. And then when you go into production, then you shrink it down. Then you're using that version there.
True, true. That would then be on probably a native Linux host, yeah, instead of trying to run it my laptop. Railcar, Rust. Why Rust?
So this actually comes from when we were building some container stuff internally starting a couple of years ago. I started using and trying to make some changes to Run C, which is the standard implementation of the runtime. And if you look at the code, it gets a little bit messy. And the reason it gets messy, and there's a great article about this posted by some of the guys at Weaveworks, it's actually really hard to deal with namespaces properly inside of Go. And the reason is the kernel developers decided that there's some namespace-related things that you must do before you do any forking in the program. And so you need to be single-threaded. And the Go runtime, as soon as it starts, forks multiple processes, and then which makes it very convenient for doing things like channels, et cetera, Go routines. But suddenly you can no longer do the things you need to do around Linux namespaces. And so what that means is for Run C, you end up with there's a chunk of code written in C that runs before the Go runtime starts to do all the namespace entering, et cetera. And then it jumps into the Go runtime and starts doing the rest of the container setup there. Now, that's kind of ugly for a couple of reasons. One is the C part of the code you have to be very careful with because it's not memory safe. You could have security issues there. And then secondly, you have to write things in two different languages, and you have to have kind of a communication path. They pass stuff via environment variables, and it gets kind of messy. So when I discovered that, I was like, you know what? This would be a great case to use Rust because Rust has a lot of the user friendliness of Go. It has a lot of the higher level language constructs of Go, but it's got memory safety and it's really good at interacting with low level stuff like the Linux kernel, talking over sockets, forking and doing syscalls. So it seemed like kind of a perfect combination where you could do everything in one language and have this really efficient implementation that doesn't have the same dual language problem that Run C has.
Now, you said that these projects have been have they been open source for 2 years or just been under development for 2 years?
No. We started it a couple of years ago. It took us quite a while to get through the process. And so they've been open source now for about 3 months, I think.
Yeah.
Have you gotten favorable responses from the community?
Yes, very much so. I mean, there was the standard little bit of Oracle bashing here and there. In general, the people that have actually gone in and looked at the code and started using it have been pretty fascinated and interested. And as I said, we've gotten some contributions.
Well, that's good. And are the teams, you probably can't answer this, but if you can, it's like, do you have like just a small team working on this internally or is it a large team?
Small.
Okay. Like you and two other people?
It's not a massive undertaking for sure. It's a few people.
So do you see other projects join these three in terms of solving microcontainer issues? Is there anything on the horizon that's interesting?
Bob, you want to handle that one?
Yeah, sure. A lot of the work we're doing, and actually we were at the Open Source Summit last week. We joined the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, rolled out an open source Terraform installer for Kubernetes for our bare metal cloud. We've also rolled out Kubernetes on Oracle Linux. So a lot of the open source work we're doing is shifting and looking at or expanding to look at Kubernetes around security, around federation. We're looking at the SIG test group and conformance. So a lot of the next set of efforts we're doing are, you know, we talked about productization and how do we take a make these containers and applications more operational. And as we look at Kubernetes, that's kind of the become the standard for moving container-based applications into production, orchestrating them, scheduling them, managing them. So we're putting a lot of effort into contributing. We have TJ Fontaine, who's our lead contributor, who's comes out of the Node.js group, was the lead contributor there. Fish is involved. But things that are really important to us are, as we talked about, security, testing, and then a particular interest, too, is around federation of how we take a look at cross-cloud, sort of open cloud environments where maybe Kubernetes is running in a federated mode, some stuff on-premise, some stuff in the cloud, our cloud, maybe another cloud, too. We think these models are consistent with what customers are doing in terms of cross-cloud, cloud-neutral, all plays into the community-driven open source part. So we're putting a lot of open source efforts into there, along with, you know, continuing to look at utilities like Bish is looking at too. So, it's a broad commitment to a set of things around what the Cloud Native Computing Foundation is working on. We're using other kind of tools too, and kind of excited about the push around making these open and community-driven. And that's, once again, as Bish has said, this is important to kind of what our customers are looking for, having something that runs on-premise, runs on their laptop, runs the DevOps cycle out to production, can run on our cloud, but run in other clouds too. They want that portability, and open source provides the stack that allows you to move those things around. So.
Yeah, I was just at the Open Source Summit last week, and I saw your announcements in the keynotes, and that was like, that was really awesome, actually, that you're stepping up to really help with that. I'm not familiar. Does Oracle have a Docker as a service project?
Yeah, so Stack Engine, who was acquired, is where the Austin group came from, where we sit now. We came from an acquisition about 2 years ago. The first thing we did was take the Stack Engine Docker Container Management Service and released that as a container service on Oracle Cloud last fall, about a year ago at Open World. So that's been out and running as a Docker container service, very similar to EC2 container services from AWS and other sort of Docker-centric services. Our next big push is around Kubernetes, which is kind of that next phase of maturation in the sort of the operational phase of taking Docker and container-based apps into production. So we're looking at a lot of Kubernetes activities. We use Kubernetes internally and to schedule and manage a lot of our internal services on Oracle Cloud. So looking at bringing a whole bunch of new announcements next week at Open World, or 2 weeks actually, in 2 weeks, that'll focus on these kind of capabilities, particularly around things in the container stack area that go above Docker into orchestration, scheduling, et cetera. So stay tuned. Good stuff coming.
And it's amazing how many times I heard the word Kubernetes during the week. It was like everybody had some talk based around it. But the most unusual one I saw, I don't know if you got a chance to see this one, was it was basically a Kubernetes versus Mesos sort of discussion. And at the end of that talk, they said they found a way to hook them up together as of like 3 weeks ago. I'm like, oh, okay. It's got to be the worst of both worlds with the best of a little bit of both worlds. So I don't know. It's like any movie you see where there's two directors. You know it's going to suck.
That's right. It's like a science experiment gone wrong. So.
Yeah, that's right. Or if the writer is the same as the director. Same as the lead author, the lead actor, whatever. The more names are the same, the more it's just likely going to be brilliant or really suck. So yeah. Hey, Dan, you got some more questions for these guys?
I was actually going to ask a bit of a joke question for Bob. Actually, I can see a board behind you there. You're not giving away company secrets, are you? Because I happen to see there's don't look at that board up there. Because I've copied all that down. What's the word on the left? I'm joking. We've lost the signal. Sorry, on a more serious note, though. So you mentioned that there's cool stuff coming. Have you got a roadmap for this? Is there anything you can give away on that at all?
Yeah, I think we've been pretty clear on the stack we're committing to and been pushing on the Kubernetes side of things. So we've acquired a company, which we announced at DockerCon in the spring this year here in Austin, called Worker, W-E-R-C-K-E-R, European-based CI/CD solution, very container-centric. So it's another part of the tools that we're bringing together too. So I think what you'll be looking forward to in terms of preview is trying to look at, when we look at kind of what's going on with containerization and the whole container native stack, customers are either looking at a Red Hat OpenShift or Cloud Foundry, which is kind of like the full stack. You take everything and it's sometimes proprietary, very opinionated. Some of the stuff is forked. It's not really open source, pure open source. Or you go over to Amazon, which has got a lot of discrete services, and you got to kind of assemble them yourself. So in that space in the middle, I think there's a lot of opportunity. Customers are looking for that open cloud neutral capability where things work together, but I can bring in what I want. I can use open source tools like the tools Bish has been talking about and the stuff we're looking to contribute into Kubernetes. So in that space in the middle, I think is a big open horizon that we're kind of looking to engage with the community with. And since people are looking for avoiding cloud lock-in, we're not really concerned about where the market is today, really is where it's going next. And this open source movement really opens up a lot of opportunities for customers to choose the best cloud, best environment, the best stack for whatever their workload or use case is. So,
Excellent. Vish, as well, I want to ask you the kind of the future question. I've asked you to predict the future once, but I'm going to ask you again, I'm afraid. It's what's coming up in the future? What are you working on that you're excited about that you can't wait to get out there?
So I have a strong desire and commitment to continue to do as many open source things as possible here. My background, I came from OpenStack. So I was at NASA when we created OpenStack, and I led the compute project for a number of years. So I see how powerful an idea can be, because a lot of what OpenStack was building a community around an idea. And it's very clear that containers have become very, very popular recently. And so I see a lot of continued work at Oracle on containers, especially as it relates to cloud. I've also recently started working on machine learning, which is another huge buzzword, right? That's everybody's talking about these days. And so what I think you'll start to see over time is more and more intelligence and machine learning included, and more cloud services built around containers, all with a very open source bent.
Excellent. And I'm going to pinch some of Randall's questions here, but I know he always likes to ask about your favorite programming language. I don't know if you're free to really say this. Do you have to say it's Java, or can you say something else?
No. So
what's your favorite language to work in, although other languages are available?
So it's a really tough question, because I'm definitely a polyglot. I use a lot of languages. So I was Python for a long time. Go is my go-to language if I want to build something that I think I want other people to understand very, very quickly. And it has some huge benefits in terms of almost anybody who's written any C-like or Java-like language can read the code. And it tends to be non-surprising what it does in almost every case. The most fun language I think that I've worked with recently is Rust. That's been a blast. Like having that low level control is really fascinating, especially for someone who I did C++ in the past, which was extremely painful dealing with memory, and it simplifies all of that. But it's not something you just like jump into and kind of play around with. It's like you spend a couple weeks banging your head against a wall trying to figure out how the borrow checker works. So I think that was a dual answer, but I think it's a fight between Go and Rust in terms of my favorite languages currently.
Yeah. Okay. And so since Dan already stole my programming question, I want to ask you the editor question. What text editor do you use all day?
I use Vim.
Okay. Didn't get either one of those. No Emacs anymore. No Emacs. No Perl. No Dart. Dart will be the next big one, though, of course. Bob, I'd ask you the same two questions, but I think you're more of a manager type, right?
Yeah. My development days were over, so. After Lisp and Emacs, that was it for me. So,
yeah, Emacs. At least we got an Emacs in there. All right, thank you. and Emacs Lisp, of course, right? Doing customizations,
yes.
Oh yeah. I wrote the Pretty Printer. So I wrote pp.el that gets invoked whenever you write out a pretty thing. Yeah. And Richard Solomon called it brilliant. He said, whatever I did, it was brilliant because I didn't want to have to count in and out parentheses. So basically I just flatten it and I know where to insert new lines, but I don't care about the indentation. So then I just call indent buffer. Using the built-in indenter to do the right thing. He called it brilliant. And it's now part of every copy of Emacs. A little bit of me going out in there. We're almost out of time. We went through a lot of different subjects here, but is there anything we didn't ask that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before we have to let you go?
I think you pretty much covered it. I was going to say, let me elaborate a little bit on one point that we did kind of cover. The purpose of having standards in a company is we started out trying to use Docker behind a bunch of our services. And it wasn't that Docker itself was a problem. The problem was that you have 30 different teams building images and there was no consistency between them. You know, some things are loading environment variables. Some guys have 4 gig images. Some things built off of some old random version of Ubuntu. You just don't know where everything's coming from. And that becomes a management nightmare. And so one of the drivers of microcontainer, the creation of microcontainers is just, hey, have some standards that is easy enough for developers to use that they actually use them. And so that was that was the goal.
And let's also talk about a call for action. What kinds of people are you missing in terms of resources that would help out a bunch?
In terms of the open source community?
Yeah.
There's a ton that can be done. I mean, one of the things you mentioned earlier about upstreaming stuff into Docker, I would love some people to come help try and tackle that problem. That seems like a really interesting approach to try and take some of the pieces out of Smith and put them into Docker and work with the community on getting those in.
Okay. Sounds like a good call to action. Well, like I said, it's been great having you guys on. We're almost out of time, so I need to let you guys go. Thanks for coming and talking about Oracle open source, particularly around the area of Smith, CrashCart, and RealCar, which are about micro containers. Thanks much, guys, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Awesome. So that was finding the name right here somewhere. Bob Quillian, something like that, close. And Vishishai Abrams. And I apologize for mispronouncing his name at the beginning of the show. I actually miscopied from the upper part of my screen. So, Dan, what'd you think?
Yeah, really interesting. I was very pleased to hear that they want to upstream things. I mean, I don't want to come across as the boring one who has to say, what about the standards and all the rest of it? But it sounds really cool that they're really interested in working with with outside sources and stuff. And actually, on just a technical level, I'm really impressed by the way they've managed to solve some of the challenges of shrinking a container, because it sounds simple. You go, oh, we just dump some stuff we don't need. But it's hard to know what you need and what you don't need. And, you know, you've got to be really clever with that stuff. So, hats off to them there.
Yeah, especially being able to scan the needed libraries and make sure that those end up in the image. So that's definitely a plus, you know, because I was thinking about, if I had to invent this from scratch, what would I have to figure out to do right? And that's probably definitely one of the things that they've already solved. This is definitely one of those projects that since my primary source of income, ZipRecruiter, is moving from a huge monolith administrative server and web server and things like that, they're moving into microkernel or microcontainer, not microcontainers, but like individual services following 12-factor app, things like that. And I think this idea of being able to really rip down an image might be something that's interesting to them. So I'm going to definitely forward this on to them later today when I get a chance to chat with my buddies back in ZipRecruiter down in, where is that? Santa Monica, yes. I haven't been there a while, so I don't remember. I wasn't there last week. I was in LA last week, which is sort of adjacent, but not Santa Monica in particular. So let's talk through who's coming up. We've got next week, speaking of the CNCF, CNCF is the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, I think that's the right terms. And it's funny because at the Open Source Summit, they had like 400 business icons. All of their business logos, all like little bars drawn around them, like whether they're platform or whether they're, you know, vertical or whatever. And they added like 5 more new little icons just there that morning. So it's like, okay, CNCF's really jumping in. Well, one of the things that happened recently, and if you've read this in the press, is that CNCF has got a deal now from Packet. Packet's a hosting company. And if you're a member of the CNCF, you can actually host for free and do all your tests in very realistic bare metal hardware or Docker setups and stuff like that. So we've got two people, one actually from CNCF next week and one from Packet, both talking about this, completely donated to the community hosting services so that you can, not run production apps, but at least have, high performance places to test your software out in. And everybody's gets the benefit of that if you can get your code to work better with that kind of hardware. So that's cool. Following that, libgit2, which is the embeddable Git core. So it's sort of the allows you to say write programs that have that act like Git, but GitLab uses that to be able to talk to the Git archives. It's all embedded in the libgit2. Following that, openbenchmarking.org, which as I understand it is just like it sounds, benchmarking with all sorts of configurations of hardware, configurations of software. You could submit stuff there. You can run your own tools for that to submit all that up or just look at the resources there. Shut up, dogs. Shut up, dogs. All right. Dogs. Dogs like to bark. Three little yip dogs here. That's the only downside of this. Following that, Project Flogo. I think we just added this last week, which is IoT integration for devices. Because, when you try to put a whole NPM stack, a whole Node.js stack, it's huge. And so this is actually just getting down to the bare metal stuff for IoT, so it looks really, really cool. Might want to bring you back on that one if you're all interested in devices and stuff. Bedrock, which is a distributed database built on SQLite. JFrog Artifactory is actually something we're going to be using at ZipRecruiter. It's a repo manager for binary artifacts. Lets you progress through various dev and staging and production and keep track of everything that's being deployed so that you can have these artifacts correct. And Crail, which is high-performance storage networking. Just added to the schedule. I was so moved by this when I got the letter in. I think my first ever letter from Zimbabwe. This guy works at an ISP. I forget his name, so I didn't put it down here. Works at an ISP, and one of the problems they have is that the data rates are so low. So what he's figured out how to do is he'll go into a business. Seems like everybody's got smartphones, though. So he'll go into a business and have a capture portal, a captive portal, that has preloaded on it, like the local menu or maybe things that are nearby, so that you don't have to search for all this stuff over Yelp. You just basically go to the restaurant you want to go to, and here's all the stuff accessing there. So very cheap, don't know who does it, Raspberry Pis, things like that. But it's called Offnet, and I don't have a URL. He's actually building a web page just for me so I could have a listing for it. But he's based out of Zimbabwe, and I believe that is our first it might be my first letter ever from Zimbabwe, but it's definitely going to be our first guest. And I said, do you have enough bandwidth to be able to do a video Skype call? He goes, I work for an ISP. We have enough bandwidth. So I said, that's good. That's good. So he's going to be able to do a video Skype call. So those are all in the upcoming list. You go to twit.tv/floss. It's the homepage for this show. You can see those and all the other ones I'm working on. If you have a guest that should be on my show, and they aren't already on that list, it probably means I'm not talking to them yet, please have the project leader or community coordinator email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. You don't have to write that down. That's actually right on the homepage for the show. Just remember twit.tv/floss. That's the important part. We have a live stream, 9:30 a.m. Pacific time Wednesdays, back to Wednesday. Sorry, it was Thursday last week, but that was because of the big iOS announcement. It's live.twit.tv. We took, I always say this now, we took a number of questions because zero is a number.
it's always a number.
It's always a number of questions. Actually, I think it was like two or three this time. I don't know. I don't remember now. I've been too much of a blur since I didn't get much sleep last night. What else? Okay, you can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and at Merlin on Twitter. And I'm sorry for the long gap when I didn't put anything at all on Google Plus for Floss Weekly. I finally realized, oh, yes, I have to write that right tickler to be able to send out the day before show announcements, as soon as I book people too. Again, my plugs. This weekend, I have two trips that both got booked right at the last second. This weekend, you probably all know, I've mentioned it before. All my clothes are Scotty Vest. I've been, completely enclosed in Scotty Vest for like the last 10, 12 years, and I just love their work. Well, Scott Jordan, the creator of Scotty Vest, lives in Ketchum, Idaho. He invited me to his 50th birthday party a few years ago. But just last week, he says, hey, you want to come out to the company party next weekend? I went, I wonder if I have any, non-refundable tickets or anything in place. And I didn't. So I'm going to be there, which would be fun. So just hang out and just spend Saturday there. And then another amazing email like that, my buddy Captain Neil, who runs the cruises that I've been going on to for many, many years, just sent me a notice. It was like 4 or 5 days ago. It said, we have a cancellation on the upcoming cruise in 2 weeks. That means you would get a free balcony room to yourself. You'd have to pay the taxes on it, and you have to get the airplane over to there, but you will get a free room. And I went, oh my God, it's like $6,000 value. So I am on a cruise in 2 weeks, which means we're scrambling behind the scenes here at Floss Weekly to try to make sure that we can cover my absence for a couple weeks, because I can't do this from the ship. Speaking of bad Wi-Fi, that would just really suck. So I'm going to be in the Mediterranean on a free cruise out of Rome, heading over to Venice and visiting almost everything up the Adriatic seaside. So not too many Italy spots, much more like Croatia and Slovenia or whatever. I don't even know, Malta, a bunch of places that I think, even a few that I don't think I've been to before. So I might get to increase my country count, which will be even better. Then I'll be at allthingsopen.org in Raleigh, North Carolina area. So if you're going to that conference, apparently quite a few, it's like 3,000 or 4,000 people attend that conference. So please, just like I said for last week, if you see me at the conference, come up and say hi. Say, yeah, well, listen to Floss Weekly, so I know that you're out there participating on your side of that sort of thing. And then I'm also going to be on another, and then I'm going up to Baltimore to visit some friends from there. And then I'm going on another cruise through the Panama Canal in January, this time the other direction. I've been from Tampa to San Diego. I'm going from San Diego over to Tampa, and I'm only in Tampa for half a day. So if it's still kind of a little messed up there, I'll be flying out right away. So I won't have to worry about any more hurricanes on that side. So that is my plugs for now. Dan, you want to plug anything?
I don't have a lot of stuff to plug personally, but I did think of something. I obviously I'm a big Linux fan and supporter. I was just going to say to people, I organise the Liverpool the Liverpool Linux User Group, and I know they've kind of gone out of fashion a little bit now. But try and find, if you're interested in Linux, have a look, search around, find a log near you, and get involved, because there's loads of them out there. And you know, we're pretty friendly people on the whole. So yeah, go and do that. And if you want to find anything out about me, you can go to danlynch.org, and all the information's there. And I will update the blog soon, I promise.
Oh, and I did want to also add in that the reason I'm going on this cruise is one of my buddy's cruises, and it's a Scientific American cruise. And so we have four speakers. I think I've seen all of them before, but whenever we're at sea, we're going to be doing conferencing, except this cruise only has a single sea day. Every day we're in ports somewhere, because they're all right next to each other. So this should be a very active cruise. So it'll be a lot of fun. I'll probably get ashore almost every port if I can. And that's probably enough about that. I don't want anybody to say, you know, think I'm gloating. I'm happy. I'm going to the cruise. Yes, it'll be cruise number 81 for me. Oh, yeah. All right. Hey, Dan, thanks for jumping in at the last second and volunteering your energy and time. And glad to see you, take the helm every once in a while here. So appreciate that much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Cool. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.